Holy God, do I have notes tonight? I have lots of notes. I heard a podcast, a couple podcasts, in the last week with Seth Godin. And I remembered how much I love the way that Seth Godin thinks. Every time I hear him, it's like a revelation. And the way he explains things, he's so straightforward and so simple. Really, I mean, I think he's a great teacher, in all honesty. So what I've been doing is I've gone through Apple Podcasts and searched for his name, and I found like, I want to say like 30 different podcast episodes that he's been on, and I've been trying to go through one or two of them a day just to kind of, listen to them carefully instead of just rush through them. You know, I slowed the speed down on my podcast player, and actually the two episodes that I'm going to be referencing ideas from in this episode, I listened to twice because I heard one of them all the way through and realized that, there's a ton of stuff in there. I got to write down. I got to remember this stuff. So I just listened to it again and took notes. And then when I got like halfway through the second one, I was like, yep, this is a good strategy. Just listen through once to see. You know, it's like you're testing it to see if there's stuff that's worth taking out the notebook for. And then the second time sitting through and actually, you know, taking the notes and thinking about the ideas and connecting them and expanding them and putting them in your own words. You know, it's like what I say about movies and books. The first time you go through, you get caught up in the plot. You get caught up in the story, which is good. You know, that's what these things are created for, especially if it's fiction. But anything that's created and put out is to entertain you in some degree. To some degree, you know, they may be trying to educate you and all that, but they know that if they're boring, that they're failing. So one of the big things that they're working at is making sure that what you're experiencing is pleasurable. So it's understandable that the first time you go through something that you enjoy it and you forget to write down the notes and you're not thinking about the implications of all of it. That's why you go back a second time or more. You know, many of these things, like books, two times is definitely not enough. Especially like as someone who likes to write fiction, I read a fiction book multiple times, and not, I don't mean in a row, usually over many, many years. But the second or third time, sometimes even the fourth time I go through, that's when I start to understand the mechanics of what the author's doing. Like, oh, I love this scene. Well, if you're reading that scene for like the third time, you're less involved in it. And you can start to look at it and go, why? Why does this scene work so well? And that's when you get start to get really good notes. So two of the episodes that I found of Seth Godin, these are both from 2018. One is with James Altucher, and the other one is on a show called The Future of Work with Jacob Morgan, which I had never listened to before. But both full, chock full of really useful ideas. And I felt like maybe tonight would be a good night to share them, because this stuff it's really in line with some of the stuff I've been talking about recently, but it's extremely in line with, number one, the things that I've been struggling with and the things that I've been feeling and actually enacting as well in my own creative life. And in fact, one of the first things that I have in the notes, I'm so annoyed. This chair squeaks. I don't like squeaky chair. Let's put these arms down. There we go. Better. Back to what I was saying. The first thing on this list is something I've talked about for a long time. If you go all the way back to Random Badassery episodes, when Lam and I were doing that show together, this is something that we would talk about. And what we're talking about is how when you make something, you know, whether it is art or whether it is business or whether it is a product, in your mind, when you're doing it, especially if it's your first time doing something like this, you're thinking your friends and your family are going to hook you up. They're going to help you out. They're going to spread the word. And then you make it and you find out that that's not true. And a lot of people, this crushes a lot of people because they start to look at their relationships like, do these people even care about me? And they get in this like super emo phase because of it. You know, for example, I've been podcasting for over 4 years, and there are people in my life, people that I know, people that I love, that have never listened to a single thing I've ever recorded. Not once. And I know that because they'll tell me, like, oh, I got to check that out someday. Like, you know how many different iterations I've gone through since you first heard about this? It's one of the things that Seth Godin says, though, is he says, essentially, that your first order connections, you know, these are the people that are your friends and your family, the people that you have direct interaction with, the people that you know, your coworkers as well. These are not going to be your network. And the way he explains it is he says essentially that there's too much shame and fear and status at stake for these first order connections to help us. I've been thinking a lot about that, and I'm not positive exactly what all of that means. I'm not sure about the shame. I understand the status and the fear. The status and the fear to some degree can be the fear of promoting something that sucks. They don't want to tell you that. They don't want to tell you like, hey, I haven't read your book and I don't want to tell people you have a book because I haven't read it in case it sucks. Because we don't want to burn our equity with other people, right? Like, oh, you told me to go buy your friend's book and that thing was garbage. So there's the status that's at stake too, right? Your status in your socioeconomic location or rank. And what I think there's something that I read a long time ago that plays into this really well. There's a book called Ignore Everybody by Hugh McLeod. And one of the things that Hugh McLeod says in there is that you shouldn't take this personally because everybody is too busy with their own lives to give a damn about your book, painting, screenplay, etc. And that's something that we don't think about. You know, we've dedicated ourselves to make something, to put it out, whether it is a podcast or whether it is an app. We've been focusing on it. That's been our world, but it hasn't been anybody else's world. Their world is kids and work and finance and relationship and Twitter feuds and news and TV and their sex life and diets and their dreams. That's what they've been thinking about. That's what they're thinking about right now. They're not thinking, how can I promote this thing for you? And you have to get out of that mindset because it's poison. It really is. So I definitely think some of that could be at play in this. But then there's also a section of the book that it's probably the thing that I remember most about this Ignore Everybody book. And every time I go to look for it, I can't find it. And here's the funny thing. It's on page 2. It starts on page 1, but it's on page 2, the specific section that I always think about. And that's why I can never find it, because I'm always looking for it deeper in the book. And he literally starts the book with it, which might be why it's so memorable. So I'm actually going to read it. It's a couple paragraphs. It's not super long. But I want you to hear what he's saying about what I think is similar to what Godin is talking about, with why first order connections, there's something in that relationship that makes sharing what you do with others and helping you out difficult. So here's McLeod. Plus, a big idea will change you. Your friends may love you and they may not want you to change. If you change, then their dynamic with you also changes. They might prefer things the way that they are. That's how they love you, the way you are, not the way you become. Ergo, they might not have any incentive to see you change. If so, they will be resistant to anything that catalyzes it. That's human nature. And you would do the same if the shoe were on the other foot. With business colleagues, it's even worse. They're used to dealing with you in a certain way. They're used to having a certain level of control over the relationship, and they want whatever makes them more prosperous. Sure, they might prefer it if you prosper as well, but that's not their top priority. If your idea is so good that it changes your dynamic enough to where you need them less, or God forbid, the market needs them less, then they're going to resist the idea every chance they can. Again, that's human nature. Good ideas alter the power balance in relationships. That is why good ideas are always initially resisted. People, this is me, not McLeod anymore. People hate change, and they hate change in people around them. It sounds awful to say, but it's true. We hate it too. This is one of the reasons, like when people go to AA, one of the things they tell them is don't go hang out with the people you used to drink with. Part of that is because for you, it's really easy to fall back into that person that you were with them. But it's also because they're not going to want to see you as the new you. They're going to want to still see you as the old you. Not because they want you to fail, not because they want you to stay a drunk, but because that's how they know you. And it's really uncomfortable to see you differently. I imagine that this is one of the most difficult things for people who go through reassignment surgery. I imagine that the biggest resistance, on top of all the other things that get messed up and all this, the biggest resistance is people, they have trouble seeing the change. They have trouble connecting the fact that this person is this person, but this person doesn't look like this person. This person doesn't sound like this person. This person has facial hair. That person didn't have facial hair. That person had boobs. This person doesn't have boobs. All of that stuff is really difficult for people to get over, especially people from older generations where this idea wasn't even something that they had contemplated ever having to do. Now, of course, saying that that happens, I need to reiterate this. Just saying that things like that happen and that people may feel that way doesn't excuse people cutting other people out of their lives because of choices they make. But it's very similar when you're creating something because you're changing your status. You know, the person who becomes a writer and starts writing a lot, becomes prolific, they're changing because before that, that's not who they were. They weren't always a prolific writer. Most people, I'm sure there's a few, but most people are not always prolific writers. They go from being the person who doesn't write and who isn't acting on their ideas to the person who does. And I imagine for people as well, what's difficult about that scenario is maybe when you see somebody going out there and doing something, it reminds you that you're not, and that feels shitty. And it may not happen on a conscious level, but that could be some resistance there too. Like, ooh, I don't like thinking about this because it makes me feel bad about myself. Therefore, I'm not going to help you. Not out of spite, but just because I don't want to think about it. I just don't want it on my mind. So what's the solution to this? Well, the solution is just see your friends and your family as your friends and family and stop trying to look at them as avenues to market yourself and to sell. That's what they're there. If they happen to help out, that's awesome. If they don't, that's still awesome because they're still the people that you love. And if they aren't, well, then you got other problems to deal with, right? So instead, what people find is that it's the second order connections. The friends of the friends, those are the people that help you out. Because for them, all of that first order relationship stuff that we just talked about, it doesn't exist. They don't know you. They just heard about you from their friend. So when they hear about it, all they think is one thing. Whoa, something over there. There's something going on over there that's really cool. I want to check that out. There's something going on over there that's really cool. Let me tell this person about it. And let me tell this person about it. And there's no hangups because they're not involved in it in any way. But I think we go through this thing where we get upset when those things don't happen from our first order connections because we're dreaming big. You know, in order to complete something, we're dreaming big. We have to do that, right? You don't write a book going, I'm going to write a piece of shit. You write a book going, I'm making a masterpiece, which is has its own problems. Usually it prevents you from being able to finish the book. But you have to have some kind of positive outlook in mind. And often what happens is people go for the big win. They want the big win. They want the one thing. They want the, you know, the podcasters do this all the time. If they have guests, they're always trying to snag that one guest. They're always trying to get the one big guest, thinking that if they get that one big guest on their show, that it's going to give them numbers that they couldn't get before. And in reality, what happens is, yes, they do get numbers that they hadn't had before for one episode. Most of those people don't come back because they didn't come for the host. And of the people that come back, a good percentage of them come back for one episode and go, nope, this isn't what I want. So you get a small bump out of something you think is going to be massive. It's not to say that it's not good to have some amazing guest on. But the reason you want to have an amazing guest on is because they're an amazing guest and you get to talk to them. Screw the numbers. But the big win, that's, we don't care about our work as much when we're worried about the big win because what we start to care about is the win. The way that Seth explains this is, this is in his words. This is me explaining the way Seth explains it. You want to look for something that's more like a movement than an event. So the example that he gives is that he's been blogging for over a decade, every day. He's written over 7,000 blogs, but not one of them has ever gone viral. Not one. Yet, despite that, his blog is really popular. If you are in the marketing field, especially if you're in the new wave of marketing, where you're looking at what the internet is changing, then Seth Godin is somebody you've heard of. And most people in that field that are the innovators are reading Seth Godin's blog, listening to his podcast. Seth Godin is a movement in that sense. He's not a one event. He's not worried about one blog. He's just worried about blogging. I didn't think about this at the time when I was writing the notes, but it's about the action, not the event. It's not about the book. It's about the writing. And if you're thinking about the book and not the writing, the book's going to suck. It's going to suck royally because you got too many things in your head that shouldn't be in your head. You want to focus on the making. Focus on the act itself. Seth Godin is a really big Grateful Dead fan. Apparently he has like 200 albums by them. And one of the things he points out about the Grateful Dead is that the Grateful Dead were one of the top grossing live bands for over 10 years. They made more money than pretty much anybody you've ever heard of. They made more money touring than all of the huge bands. The Beatles, the Stones, AC/DC, Green Day. You know, I'm not saying all these people were contemporary with them at the exact time, but for over 10 years, they were one of the top grossing touring bands. Yet, in all those hundreds of albums, they only had one album that ever cracked the top 40. And he has this great quote, this amazing quote. He says that the Grateful Dead were, instead of trying to find listeners for their music, they spent all their time trying to find music for their listeners. They were focused on the making. They were focused on the music. Just keep putting, that's why they had hundreds of albums. They just kept making because the making is what they liked. Not the selling the albums and not the getting the singles and not all of the bullshit. They liked making the albums. And when you make and you make and you make and you make, people are going to find it. Not all of it. You don't need people to find everything you've made. You just need them to find the thing that you made. That's the thing that they wanted. If you make 200 albums, you only need each person to find one of them. A different one for every person. This one's my album. This one's my album. Or just maybe even just one song. Maybe not even a whole album, right? I happen to know which album the Grateful Dead wrote that went into the top 40. I don't remember the name of the album. But the song that was on it that made it was Touch of Grey. And this was later in their career. So for some people, The Grateful Dead is just that song, Touch of Grey. And for other people, they are just Truckin'. They're just the band that did Truckin'. And for other people, they are just the band that did Uncle John's Band. Or they're just the band that did Casey Jones. You don't need buy-in on the entire catalog. You just need to focus on the making. And I find that really encouraging because in case you haven't noticed, I've been putting out a lot of episodes this week. And that's, it's a consequence of what I was doing as an experiment, or I shouldn't say it in past tense, what I am doing as an experiment on my Patreon, where I told myself that I wanted to lean into this idea of the radio show, turning on the microphone every day and talking every night, not sure if anybody is on the roads with their radios on listening. I wanted to lean into that because I felt the need to do it. I had no reason to do it. The only reason I had is I wanted to. And so because of that, what I've been discovering, when I get to the end of each episode, I ask myself, I say, is this a Patreon episode or is this a public feed episode? And this week, I just happened to have recorded a lot of episodes that ended up in the public feed. And actually, in my Patreon extra last night, one of the things I was talking about was having to come to terms with that, with what that meant. What would it mean if I started recording and most of my episodes ended up in the public feed instead of in Patreon? And I decided that that's a really good problem to have. That if I really got myself into a situation where 30 days out of the average month, 28 of my episodes I wanted to publish into the public feed, that if I could really make that many episodes that I feel I want to push out to the public in a month, then I got other problems that are way, way worse than that. That's not even a problem. That's a blessing. And everybody doesn't have to listen to every episode. And let's go back to Seth Godin here. Seth Godin blogs every day. I used to subscribe to his blog. You can subscribe to it and have them emailed to you every day. And these blogs are short. Sometimes it's like two sentences. Sometimes it's like, 10, 12 paragraphs. It's really, it never takes more than 5, maybe 10 minutes to read one of his blogs. And I followed it for a while. And you know what I found out? They started backlogging on me. They started backlogging on me because I couldn't keep up. That little 5 minutes every day, it was just too much for me. But I didn't stop reading Seth's blog. I just unsubscribed from it. I just had it stop mailing to me. And then every once in a while, I would go over to his blog and I would scan through and I would look for something to read and then I would read it. I only needed the ones that I needed. podcasts. Some people do that. You know, I happen to be a completist. Like if I'm subscribed to a podcast, that means I want to hear everything they're making. Otherwise, I will do like what I do with Seth. I will just pop in on the podcast every once in a while and go, let's see which of these are new since I was last here. And of those, which sound interesting? Doesn't mean I'm any less a fan of that podcast than the ones that I subscribe to. It just means I need less from them. Seth Godin is not the only person out there that creates more stuff than their fans can or could keep up with. Joe Rogan will put out sometimes, typically, 3 to 5 episodes a week. I'm basing this off of his pre-Spotify exclusivity. I don't know how he's changed since he's gone over there, since I don't listen to him anymore. But 3 to 5 episodes a week, that's a lot. That's a lot for 1 hour episodes for the average listener. But Joe Rogan doesn't record 1 hour episodes. He records 2 to 3 hour episodes, sometimes 4 hour episodes. Most of the people that listen to Joe Rogan are not listening to every episode. They're picking and choosing. Is he successful? Wildly successful. Most people would agree he is the most well-known and successful podcast host. Isaac Asimov. When he was alive, this man wrote over 400 books. Let that sink in. 400 books. If you did that over 40 years, you'd be writing 10 books a year. Now, have all Isaac Asimov fans read every book he's ever written? No. In fact, it's really hard to find a comprehensive list. Every list you find is different than the other one. Because, I mean, he wrote science fiction books. He wrote science books. He wrote kids' books about science. He wrote introductions to other people's books. The guy was writing all of the time. He didn't need you to read them all. If all you read was iRobot, that's enough. Did you love it? You loved it. Okay, that's your book. Maybe all you read was the Foundation Trilogy. That's enough. Let's go back to radio. Daily radio hosts, people that are on the air 5 days, 6 days a week, they don't have fans that are listening every day. Or maybe they have fans that are listening every day, but they're not listening for the whole time. You know, maybe they only get 20 minutes here or there on Tuesday and 10 minutes of it there because it's live. Remember, they're not podcasts. So people are tuning in. Look at Coast to Coast AM. This show is wildly successful. Yet, if you want to catch up with it, you've either got to listen live at night. It's on late at night. Or you have to pay like $10 a month and get access to all the recorded archives. But then you're looking at these shows are 4 to 5 hours long, 7 days a week. Do you have 4 to 5 hours every day to listen to Coast to Coast? No. And you don't need to. They're just focused on the making. Isaac Asimov was just focused on the making. Joe Rogan's just focused on the making. Seth Godin's just focused on the making. And I'm trying damn hard to just be focused on the making. It's a sign. I think it's a sign to the world, too, that you're free. That you're free of restraints. I'm not saying that everybody should be doing something daily. I'm saying you should be doing everything that at the appropriate time. You know? That everybody's time is different. But you want to take advantage of the time when it's the right thing for you to be doing. And I don't mean because of marketing. I don't mean because of numbers. I don't mean because of downloads. I mean because you have the idea and you want to make something. That's the right time. And I'd be remiss to move past this section having mentioned my Patreon without saying, if you guys want to check out the Patreon, go over to patreon.com/Chad Hall. Check it out. If you like this, you'll probably like what's over there because I'm basing it off the theory of like that. Want more? Okay, there's more over there. Okay, so back to Seth Godin. One of the other things that he mentions here is what I call delivering pure ideas. Now, the way that he talks about this, he talks about the idea, we'll use the context of books because he's using the context of books. You write a book and you give it to somebody else and they go, oh, you should probably cut this because people don't like to hear about the death of animals in stories. So you'll probably lose some sales because of that. So you go, you change that. Then you hand it to somebody else and they go, you probably shouldn't use the word bitch because, well, nobody likes that word anymore and we're trying to phase it out. So let's not use that. So then you take that out and you keep handing it to people and everybody's trying to help you. They're giving you good advice, like how to make you more successful. But what's also happening is they're diluting your idea. They're not doing it on purpose. And it's not to say that you shouldn't have an editor and any of that stuff. But when you start to put it through more and more people, you filter it because what these people are doing to help you is they're filtering it to make it fit more with what already exists. Because it's based off the model of that was successful for them. Therefore, if you do something similar, it will be successful for you. But the pure ideas are what we really want. It's what we really need. We need the pure ideas, not from everybody. You know, the people writing romantic comedies, they don't need pure ideas. People who like watching romantic comedies like the fact that they're all kind of the same. They enjoy that. They enjoy the comfort of it. They love Hallmark movies. That's what they like. And something I heard from Seth before, he calls that the difference between the hack and the artist. Hack is used as a negative term for the most part, but all hack really means is you're making something for people to make money. And you're making it specifically the way that they want it, as opposed to the way that you want it. Romance novelists, detective novelists, TV writers, for the most part, these are all hacks. And there's nothing wrong with that. Most people who are starving artists, they're really, really, most of them would be happy being a hack. They'd be happy just writing and making money and delivering exactly what people want. You liked that book? Here's one that's very similar to it that I just finished. And then I'll write another one after this that's very similar to it. Stephen King can be like that. He seems to oscillate between hack and artist, which I think is what makes him such an interesting character. Sometimes he writes books that sound like Stephen King, and that's him just delivering what the audience wants. Actually, you know, one of the things that Seth Godin says, he talks about bands when they tour, especially big bands, you know, like Van Halen, when they would tour. Van Halen, I think, is the exact example he gives. He says, when they were touring, they were hacks. Once again, not a negative term. All that means is they were showing up to shows and people were saying, we want to hear this song, this song, this song, this song, and this song. And they were going, we are going to deliver this song, this song, this song, this song, and this song, because that's what you want. And that's why we're here. It's not a bad thing. In fact, it's a really good strategy for touring. If you want to make money touring, being a hack is really, really the way to do it. But when they sat down to write their albums, theoretically, that's when they were being artists. I say theoretically because I don't know if they were sitting in the room going, so what do people want? I think most bands are not hacks on their first album because they have no idea what people want. But if you intend on being original, if you intend on being an artist, if you intend on something that fits in the line with those two type of words, then you want to deliver the pure ideas because we're already getting the diluted stuff. If you want to stand out, you want to be different, you got to give the pure. And when you give that pure, you have to realize that you're sacrificing the mass. You're not going to get 10 million. You might only get 100 people in your audience. But those 100 people are going to be the people that want exactly what you're delivering. You're not making it for them, but what you're making is what they were looking for. And that's a very different relationship. This is what's referred to often as the smallest viable audience. There's a famous essay by Kevin Kelly called 1,000 True Fans. I haven't read it. I need to read it. I'd be able to insert it right here if I did. But essentially, you need to find that exact audience and talk to them. Make what you're making knowing that this is who it's going to, that this is who's looking for it. And don't worry about all the people that aren't into what you're doing. That's really, really important to think about with podcasts, because as podcasts become more and more successful and more mainstream, there are more and more choices. So people are going to be more and more selective with what they listen to. So the idea of having the Johnny Carson of podcasts is not going to happen. There's not going to be one podcast that everybody listens to the way that America used to watch TV, and all of them would watch Johnny Carson. You have to be difficult to replace. This goes back to Naval Ravikant. Naval Ravikant said something along the lines as this as well, is to be something that can't be someone who can't be replaced. I think the example he gave on his podcast was Joe Rogan, actually, that you could keep all of the same features of the Joe Rogan show, the same schedule, the same guests, Jamie as the producer, same theme song, everything. But if you remove Joe Rogan and put a different host in there, the show would fail because he's not replaceable. My example is Oprah. You know, Oprah had the show for years. Everybody remembers or has heard of probably the Oprah Winfrey Show. Well, when she retired, one of the things she did, she started a network, a TV network. But she didn't have a show on the TV network. And the network, I mean, it did well. She pumped a lot of money into it. She made some quality products. I think it's still around. I know the magazine is. It's called O. But it didn't do as well as the Oprah Winfrey Show, the network or the magazine. Why? Because people wanted Oprah. She was not replaceable. Tony Robbins, regardless of what you feel about him, the people that go to a Tony Robbins seminar are there for Tony Robbins. So imagine you paid whatever crazy price he charges for those things, $10,000 for a weekend with Tony Robbins. And you get there and somebody else is on stage saying all of his lines, but it's not him. How fast do you think it would be for people to go ask for their money back? He's not replaceable. It's in a way, it's similar to a niche, right? What people are looking for sometimes is you, if you lean into who you are. Another great piece of advice, being scared is a symptom that you're doing it right. If you're not scared, you're not trying hard enough. That's an exact quote from Seth Godin. Another quote from Godin, you're scared because you're reaching, you're making a big promise. And this goes back to James Altucher. James Altucher is one of his more famous things that he's talked about in the years he's been podcasting and writing books, is that he says he never publishes a blog unless he's scared to. Because he's not risking anything. And I think that risk and that pure idea thing, they're kind of connected, aren't they? That the risk can be that your pure idea will be rejected and that people will hate you. And yes, people will hate you. Because when you do something pure and you do something that's irreplaceable, you do something that's completely you and you focus on the making and maybe you make a ton of it, and you focus on it being a movement and not going for the big win, people are going to be repelled by it. It's human nature, as McLeod said. It's human nature. They will be repelled by it. Some people will even find it ugly because we think things that are new, things that we're not comfortable with, we think they're ugly. A great example of this, I remember, I don't know how many years ago it was. So before Taylor Swift really became a pop star, she was still like a country star. And I saw her, I think I was at somebody's house and they were watching like the Country Music Awards. And I saw her go up to get an award and I said, "That girl is beautiful." And everybody in the room looked at me like I was crazy. Like, what? She's weird looking. Now, fast forward to 2020. Do people still say that about her? No, they say she's beautiful. Why? Because she looked different than what people expected her to look like. But then once they got used to what she looked like, they saw that she's beautiful. We resist what's new because it's new and we don't know how to deal with it. Jack Kerouac, the way that he wrote, his spontaneous prose style of writing, long drawn out sentences, and he would do things where he would essentially where he would pile words on, because he believed that when you try to describe something, when you look at something like a basketball and you say it's an orange basketball, yeah, it's an orange basketball, but you say, you know, it's an orange, it's a tangerine, it's a persimmon basketball, and you just keep stacking descriptors on top, that stack of words, that the orange and tangerine and persimmon and rust and whatever other things that it kind of looks like, when you stack all those together, that's closer to what it looks like than just the one that most writers would pick. So his writing was wildly different. And he would write thinking about being a jazz horn player. Instead of the metered rhythm of a normal writer's sentence. Capote said of Jack Kerouac that he was that on the road, he said, "That's not writing, it's just typing." Because Capote thought it was ugly, it was new. Picasso and Jackson Pollock, people hated their paintings. I was thinking about albums that we love, or the, as a society, you know, like things that we consider classic albums. Some of them got bad reviews when they came out. So I found a few. I'm going to share them with you. Led Zeppelin's first album. Now, some of these are paraphrases, you know, like somebody's doctored up the words because it wasn't super clear without the context. So these aren't all exact quotes. They're like 95% quotes. And I didn't write down who the reporters are because it doesn't really matter. Because they were so wrong. But Led Zeppelin. "Jimmy Page is a very limited producer and a writer of weak, unimaginative songs. If Led Zepp are to help fill the void created by the demise of Cream, they will have to find a producer and editor and some material worthy of their collective attention." Yikes. Radiohead's OK Computer. Someone said, "Radiohead wouldn't know a tragic hero if they were cramming for their A-levels." I have no idea what that means, by the way. "And their idea of soul is Bono, who they imitate further at the risk of looking even more ridiculous than they already do." Another person wrote of another Radiohead album, Kid A, "It is the sound of Tom York ramming his head firmly up his own arse, hearing the rumblings of his intestinal wind and deciding to share it with the world." Yeah, someone described Kid A as Tom York's fart. How about Simon and Garfunkel, "Bridge Over Troubled Waters"? "Nearly all of the songs are hopelessly mediocre." Michael Jackson's "Bad" was described as a letdown to a reviewer at the Los Angeles Times. The Beatles' "Abbey Road," an unmitigated disaster. The Beatles' "Revolver," a load of rubbish, really. people are going to shit on things you do. But if you have the focus, you know you're doing all of the things that we've been talking about, it doesn't matter. Seth Godin has a really, really interesting insight on one-star reviews. He says one-star reviews, essentially he says that they're not actually a criticism of your work. Because what a one-star reviewer is saying, I wanted this, and what I got is not that. It just means that the wrong person got what you made. That they're not your audience. That these aren't the people that you made this for. And you aren't what they were looking for. A one-star review is essentially saying, this is not for me. So it's not actually a criticism of your work. It's a criticism of the fact that, damn, I ordered red and I got blue. So don't pay attention to them. You can't learn anything from them. They're not going to teach you how to be better because they're not your audience. So they have no idea how what you're doing could be better. You have to, I've said this before, you have to lean into your weird. The thing that stands out in what you create that people often tell you you should change might actually be the thing that you should focus on more, because that might be the thing that makes you unique. It might be the ugly that people are not comfortable with yet. It took me a long time to feel confident with talking into this microphone and hearing the way that sometimes I move through sentences like William Shatner. And sometimes I pause because I need to think about the rest of my sentence. And sometimes I stumble over words, and sometimes I start sentences and jump to other sentences. But that's my style. It's how I talk in real life. I'm not putting on an air, and I'm not nervous because I'm in front of a microphone. I'm literally learning more and more to talk the way that I talk in real life. It's me being me. And it took a while to accept that. So the final insight from Seth Godin that I'm going to share is that innovation and art, they come from things that might not work. And you have to accept that too, that what you're doing might not work at all. But if you don't do the things that might not work, you'll never get to the things that you actually want to create. Because we don't all have 100% accuracy with our ideas. But if you don't make things when you think about them, if you spend too much time mitigating whether they'll work or not, you've already lost the battle. You have to make all of it, I think. You know, not all at once, but the idea is that the ones that pull at you that you can't let go of, you got to do them. And trust me, it sucks sometimes. It sucks because sometimes you're so excited about it and nobody else is. Because you're not... This has nothing to do with the first order connections and second order connection. This has to do with the fact that nobody knows who you are yet. You know, if you make something and everybody in the world sees it, the chances of nobody liking it, I would say, are zero. But the problem is, when you make something now, and or any stage below that, I mean, even the most famous people are stages below that. When you let it go into the world and you find out nobody likes it, it's not that nobody likes it. It means that nobody heard it who heard it, or nobody who saw it liked it. The people who would like it just didn't know it existed. So you have to make those things. And I think this goes back to that numbers thing of just focusing on the making, you know, 200 Grateful Dead albums. Well, maybe the Grateful Dead made an album that nobody paid attention to, but they kept making albums and people started connecting with those albums and like, oh, you know what? This 10th album they made, I love that one. I'm going to go back and listen to some of the other ones. And they go back and they hear number two, and maybe number two was the album nobody listened to. And this person who liked album 10 hears number two and goes, oh, I love this. That's the argument for making a lot, right? Because the things you make now and the things you make in the future might lead people to the things you made in the past that nobody was interested in. That's my theory, at least. I mean, what the hell do I know? I'm making podcasts every day. Do I have a huge audience? No. I'm still playing the long game that I'm describing here. But I'm being me. I'm delivering the pure ideas. I'm doing as many of these things that I can. And I'm going to keep listening to Seth Godin episodes over the next week. Maybe we'll have another episode where I bring in some more of his ideas, because they're good. They're really good ideas. They get me excited. They get me excited because it's not asking me to redefine everything. It's asking me, he's asking me to see what I'm already doing and to essentially lean into it and to do what is naturally what I am driven to do. And that the people who like it, it's there for them. I won't say they'll find it, because you never know, but it's there. It exists. And that's comforting. I think that's comforting. On the days when you feel like nobody gives a shit, sometimes that's enough. It's like maybe someday somebody will find it and they will like it. That's enough. So, anyways, hope you enjoyed this episode. Obviously, I'm putting this one into the public feed because this one is full of insights that I think the world needs to hear. I'm going to put the links to the two episodes that I've pulled these ideas out of with Seth Godin. I recommend you go to the source. You go listen to him. He's also far more articulate and so much better at explaining than I am. So go check those out. And the dinner bell just rang, which means it's time for me to give the dog the treat, which means I didn't plan my recording well. If you want to follow me on Twitter, you can find me as The Real Chad Hall. And there are many ways that you can support this show. I have a page on my website called Lend a Hand. It has 10 different ways you can help support this podcast. One of which, of course, is my Patreon, patreon.com/Chad Hall. I mentioned it earlier. Go check that out. Check out the other stuff on there too. Things like buying books from the links in the description that I give. Yeah, that helps. Sharing episodes on social media. Those are a couple of the things. Go check out the other things on there. And if you enjoyed this particular episode, I'm going to recommend an episode from the archive. This is just from a few days ago. If you haven't heard the episode, episode 28, An Introduction to the Elephant, that's where I kind of talk about some of the obsessions that I've had recently, like with late night radio and public access television and VHS culture, and how that plays into, or possibly plays into, my creativity. So go check that one out. And I guess that's enough. So talk to you whenever I'm back. Bye.